Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Lawmakers question where to draw the line on a distracted driving crackdown.
Have you ever been driving down I-75 and seen somebody driving with a paperback novel on their steering wheel?
Also this week, a Senate panel takes health regulators to task over delays in rolling out the latest medical marijuana legislation.
I'm not buying that just because there's litigation out there, you can't fulfill your statutory duty to issue these additional licenses. I'd like your response to that.
We'll also get updates on proposed state legislation banning underage marriage, tackling juvenile justice abuses, and discover what the future may hold in the first Florida public school district to be taken over by a charter school operator. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. Florida lawmakers are grappling with where one person's rights end and another's begin as debates over a texting while driving bill turn emotional. We get that story from Regan McCarthy.
I'm here today with numerous families who have lost loved ones to distracted driving.
Tears streamed freely as mothers like Jody Dominguez and fathers told lawmakers in a Florida Senate committee about the untimely deaths of their daughters and sons. Debbie Wanikoff's son was killed by a driver who was momentarily distracted while using her cell phone.
Of course, no one law can ever fix a problem all by itself. We need to change the culture surrounding cell phone use and driving. We can start doing this by making cell phone use while driving a primary offense. After all, if we save just one life, wouldn't it be worth it? Safety first, always.
Lawmakers are considering a move that would take texting while driving from a secondary offense to a primary offense, meaning it's enough reason for a person to be pulled over and ticketed. Gainesville Republican Senator Keith Perry is behind the bill, which bars texting while driving, but allows other cell phone uses that require just a few keystrokes, such as placing a call or finding a route through the phone's GPS system. And that's where some of the contention surrounding the bill has been rooted. Tampa Republican Senator Dana Young questions how the line is drawn.
Have you ever been driving down I-75 and seen somebody driving with a paperback novel on their steering wheel?
Yes.
I have too. Shaving?
Not very often.
Shaving with a Norelco? Seen that? Have you ever seen that?
That wasn't me. I stopped using Norelco a while ago.
A battery-powered curling iron. I've seen that. Have you ever seen that?
No, I've not seen that one.
Uh-huh. And watching a
You're
movie.
You're more observant than me.
Yeah, watching a movie with an iPad. You ever seen that?
Yeah.
All examples of egregious driving practices that lead to careless driving, distracted driving.
Young says lawmakers should crack down on all distracted driving, not just drivers who are texting. And Lake Worth Democratic Senator Jeff Clemons largely agrees.
My main concern here is not giving people false hope that this is going to solve the problem. If we're going to actually do something to solve the problem, and we really want to do something to solve the problem, we should just not have people be able to use their phones when they're driving. If we want to give people false hope that a primary texting ban is going to make that much of a difference, the statistics, at the very least, are conflicting.
Clemons proposed two amendments. One would require people to use hands-free devices to operate their phones while driving. That proposal failed. The other would require law enforcement officers to let people know they aren't legally required to hand over their phones in the event of an accident. That amendment passed. The bill passed as well, and we'll move on to the next committee stop. Perry says he realizes the measure isn't perfect and that there could still be distracted drivers on the road or concerns over enforcement. But he's hopeful the measure will begin to normalize the idea that driving and using a phone simply shouldn't be done. He says that's what happened with seatbelt use.
With seatbelts now, I have a 17-year-old and a 20-year-old daughter. Nobody has to tell them. They've never gotten a ticket for that, and they never will, because they immediately put their seatbelts on when they get in the car, not because even of a threat that they would get a ticket. It's simply because that's their behavior now.
Meanwhile, Lakeland Republican Kelly Stargell, who voted against the bill, suggests parents take the wheel by installing apps on their kids' phones that block them from texting while they're driving. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Well, once again, proving if it's Friday, anything can happen. This late word from the Capitol as this edition of Capitol Report was going to air. State Senator Jeff Clemons, who was included in the story we just heard from Regan McCarthy and who was to be the incoming leader of Florida's Senate Democrats, has announced his resignation. The announcement follows news about an affair between Clemons and a lobbyist. In a statement, Clemons said, "All women deserve respect, and by my actions, I feel I have failed that standard. I have to do better." Clemons says he will focus now on being a better husband and father, something he feels he'll be better able to do outside of elected office. Florida health officials are under fire for the slow rollout of new medical marijuana licenses. Nick Evans reports state lawmakers are rejecting the department's excuses.
A new state law directed the Office of Medical Marijuana to issue 10 new dispensing licenses by October 3rd. They didn't make the deadline.
We want to move this process as quickly as possible forward. The problem is that, you know, there is a branch of government that's not represented in this room right now, and they have a say over whether or not something is procedurally correct, administratively correct, or constitutionally correct.
Christian Bax heads up the Florida Office of Medical Marijuana, and he points to pending litigation as the reason for the licensing delay. Senate Health Policy Chair Dana Young is incredulous.
So are you saying that you are willing to hold off on issuing any further licenses as required by statute because you have litigation filed? Is that what you're saying, that you're going to wait until this litigation is resolved before you issue any additional licenses?
Yes.
Members, just with your indulgence, I want to continue on this line of questioning because it is not that hard to file a lawsuit.
The Tampa Republican spent a good chunk of this year's session attempting to corral the different ideas senators had for medical marijuana. Lawmakers in both chambers tangled so long over what would make it in the final bill that they didn't reach an agreement until the June special session. Young points out existing licensees could use lawsuits to protect their market position. She also suggests the office is drifting from its lane by presupposing what administrative judges might rule. But most fundamentally, she just doesn't buy the office's explanation.
Doesn't it seem a bit complacent for you to simply throw your hands up and say, oh, we cannot issue, we've been sued, oh no. You all get sued all the time. You know, we've been sued, so we can't do anything. That you have a duty under our state laws to issue these licenses, regardless of whether some plaintiff files a lawsuit.
Naples Republican Kathleen Passidomo is similarly skeptical of the litigation argument. Plantation Democrat Lauren Book raises a different concern, criticizing the lag time in receiving a patient ID card.
I tried the process, and I went through it as an experiment. And it took 3 months to get a patient identification card. And that is not unique. That is something that I have heard time and time and time again.
That hurts patients, Book says, because they can't simply take their prescription to a dispensary. They have to sign up with the state, and the Office of Medical Marijuana has to verify the application before a patient can begin receiving treatment. Back says those strictures are part of the measure lawmakers approved earlier this year. But his office is about to hand off ID card production to an outside vendor.
Moving forward with this card vendor and outsourcing this program is going to be a significant and marked improvement on this process in that we will remove these logistical challenges of operating within a relatively small office, and this vendor will be able to produce these cards at an industrial scale.
Book also questions the difficulty of switching doctors. Patients have to remove themselves from the state registry and then re-register. But again, Back says that's because of one doctor, one patient requirements baked into state law. When it comes to the identification card, since the hearing, the New Service of Florida reports an unsuccessful vendor will challenge the Office of Medical Marijuana's contract decision in court, potentially delaying the handoff in making and distributing identification cards. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
With the state facing a likely budget shortfall and costs from Hurricane Irma, House Speaker Richard Corcoran made clear during this committee week that he opposes dipping into reserves to balance the 2018-2019 state budget. During a news conference at the state capitol, Corcoran told reporters the Republican-led House campaigned on being fiscal conservatives. Corcoran says the state's current level of reserves is a minimum number, in his words, and is not something the House would support tapping. He feels dipping into reserves for non-emergency situations could affect the state's bond rating, which could increase borrowing costs. Governor Rick Scott is expected to propose a budget in the coming weeks, with the House and Senate negotiating a final spending plan during the session that starts in January. Loopholes in Florida law are allowing hundreds of children to get married every year. Activists and survivors of child marriage are fighting to change that.
I was home, crying, not knowing what to do with my life because now I'm kicked out of school. I can't go to work. I got three children. You know, what do you do?
As Florida lawmakers mull over what to do to address abuses within Florida's juvenile justice system, the chief of the state agency in charge of that area already has some suggestions.
This is an environment that can be very challenging, and we need to have the right people working with our kids. Help us in giving us our staff a raise so we can recruit people that are focused on our kids.
And the superintendent of the first school district in Florida to be run by a charter school network talks about what it will take to turn things around.
I believe, truly believe, that parents have the ultimate responsibility for educating their children. And that means that it's our job to make sure that they have as many options as possible.
The U.S. State Department considers child marriage a human rights abuse. Still, the practice continues, not just in faraway places, but also in the state of Florida. Kate Payne reports a coalition is walking the halls of the state capitol to change that.
For Sherry Johnson, the rapes started at age 8. When a member of her church got her pregnant, Johnson's mother forced her to marry him. She was 11. He was 20. A county clerk in Tampa wouldn't issue the couple a license, so they went to neighboring Pinellas County. She said the marriage derailed her life.
I was home, crying, not knowing what to do with my life because now I'm kicked out of school. I can't go to work. I got three children. You know, what do you do? What do you do?
And at such a young age, Johnson had virtually no chance at independence.
I remember applying for apartments, but they told me you weren't old enough. You couldn't get an apartment. I applied for jobs. I remember getting the classified ads and applying for jobs, calling people and telling them I would like to work. The moment they asked me my age, it was a no, an automatic no.
The reason Johnson's forced marriage could even happen is because of a loophole in Florida law. Generally, people younger than 18 can't get married, but there are exceptions.
First of all, parental consent. If a parent signs a marriage license application, a child age 16 or 17 can marry in Florida.
That's Frady Reese, head of the Forced Marriage Support Organization, Unchained at Last. There's also a judicial review option for those who have a child.
A child of any age can marry if she is pregnant or if she or he already has a baby.
Boynton Beach Democratic Representative Lori Berman says many of these marriages are forced or coerced.
Just because you raised a child doesn't mean you should be able to commit them to an adult relationship.
According to the Bureau of Vital Statistics, Florida counties issued 1,828 marriage licenses to minors between 2012 and 2016. 132 of those licenses went to couples where both were minors. That means in 93% of cases, a minor was marrying an adult. Reese says, just as Sherry Johnson experienced, there are very few options for children in this situation.
Because helping a child leave home is a crime here in Florida. Domestic violence shelters are not allowed to take in children before their 18th birthday. Contracts with children are voidable, meaning a retainer agreement with a child is pretty much worthless, and bringing a legal action in his or her own name is impossible for a child, illegal here in Florida.
When she was 17, Johnson's rapist was imprisoned for not paying child support for their 6 children. She was finally able to get a divorce, and she says she's still recovering. Reese says the experience has lifelong impacts.
Right here in the United States, a woman who was married at or before age 18 faces a 23% greater risk of heart attack, cancer, diabetes, and stroke, and an increased risk of nearly every psychiatric disorder that's ever been identified. And these serious health consequences come because of the forfeited education and the increased risk of poverty.
Heather Barr researches child marriage around the world for Human Rights Watch.
I've interviewed hundreds of survivors of child marriage myself in 5 different countries, and what we find is that the harms are remarkably consistent, the harms that Frady described. It doesn't really matter if you live in Bangladesh or in Zimbabwe or in Tampa.
Proponents of the ban on child marriage say there's virtually no opposition. But Johnson says that's not the case. She lobbied state lawmakers back in the 2014 session.
People wasn't aware of what was going on. They would debate with me saying that it didn't happen.
The bill never made it out of the committee process in either chamber.
And some don't want to know. They close their eyes to it.
But this year, Johnson says the issue of child marriage in Florida is getting more attention than before. She hopes lawmakers will continue to open their eyes to survivors like her. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
In the coming weeks, the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice will be putting the finishing touches on a newly created office where juveniles and their families can raise concerns. As Sasha Cordner reports, that's just one of the reforms the head of DJJ recently told a group of lawmakers who had some suggestions of their own to address abuses within the system that were outlined in a Miami Herald investigative series.
As she said in the past, Florida Department of Juvenile Justice Secretary Christy Daly says she's not denying what was reported in the Miami Herald articles, but at the same time,
I will not let a newspaper series overshadow the accomplishments that have been made.
Some of those accomplishments include seeing a 52% decline in the number of girls arrested. And Daly says in the 6 years since she and her predecessor Wansley Walters were in office, there have been some big changes, like therapy dog programs and making the juvenile facility rooms seem more homey.
And also simply even changing what these kids wear. Back in 2011, kids were still wearing the orange jumpsuits. Now they wear khakis and polo shirts. And, we are really trying to focus on breeding our young people to become very responsible, productive adults.
Plus, Daly says what was outlined in the Miami Herald is nothing new and has been reported by different news outlets when they occurred, and her agency has done a lot to hold the people accountable. Still, lawmakers like Lakewood Democratic Senator Jeff Clemens say they appreciate the reporting organized into one comprehensive document that the legislature could see.
But I don't think, we should forget, some of these incidences and when you're talking about somebody being beaten and stomped by 12 boys or, sexually assaulted or hit with a broomstick, I've got 4 or 5 pages of incidents that are listed. So it isn't a one-off incident that happened once. It's something that's happened across these facilities.
Lawmakers have also continually been caught up on the controversial issue of privatization, Juvenile detention centers are state-run. They are where a juvenile may be awaiting a court date or placement in a residential program. But residential facilities are 100% privatized and house juveniles required by a judge to serve a sentence and undergo treatment. Here's Miami Republican Senator Anna Terry Flores recently questioning Daily about how the facilities are rated.
And one of the things that I think is concerning is that in some of the places where these incidents had occurred, they were rated as something that would not be reflective of a horrible incident had occurred there. So if you could talk to us a little bit about the rating system, how and is it different for a public provider, for a private provider, and what does there need to be a change either within the agency or by the legislature to ensure that an agency where a horrible incident is happening is not getting rated as something that is not reflective of that?
While some lawmakers want to back away from the privatized structure, others like Ocala Republican Senator Dennis Baxley told Daily they like what's in place.
One of the things I like about this structure is you're not in a position that you have to defend a provider. You know, if you are the provider, then you've got to defend what you did or didn't do. But you can actually help us in this posture with this structure review what they're doing and take action against them, including closing them or canceling their contract ultimately.
Other ideas proposed by lawmakers include putting a more independent party in the facility, like a school resource officer, or having live cameras in all DJJ facilities. As for Daly, she says there are some things lawmakers can do. They include giving probation and detention officers a 10% pay raise so DJJ can have better and more experienced staff who know how to work in such a sensitive environment. Daly also has reforms she's in the process of implementing, like the creation of the Office of Youth and Family Advocacy.
This is something I'm extremely excited about. The director of this office will be a direct report to me, and we will be working in the coming weeks to solidify the formal focus of this office. My vision is to have an office which will amplify the voices of children served by this agency and the voices of their families. The advocates will be an additional set of eyes and ears in programs with the sole purpose of identifying any unmet need of children and their families. This office will also be focused on increasing our family engagement.
Meanwhile, some Democratic lawmakers have already filed bills allowing for surprise inspections of DJJ facilities, just as legislators can do in Florida's adult correctional facilities. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally, this week, after years of poor student academic performance, a crumbling infrastructure, and budget deficit, North Florida's Jefferson County school system became the state's first charter school district this year. Today, it has fewer than 1,000 students, and all attend a consolidated K-12 school run by Somerset Academy, a charter school network. Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter sat down with Jefferson Superintendent Marianne Arbelu to talk about the future of Jefferson, what happened, and what's left to do.
How has that transition been? What has happened since then?
It's good news and bad news, Lynn. So not bad news, but good news and some bumps in the road. That's more appropriate. So we have two parallel things going on. One is the academic side and the transition to Somerset with the charter school, and the focus, of course, over the summer and spring was to make sure that Somerset was poised to open the doors in August, and they did a fabulous job. I can't speak highly enough about our charter partner, all the work that they put into renovating the school, making sure that we had bus routes to keep our children get our children at the school on time and keep our students on campus as long as possible to take advantage of after-school programs, the improvements to the school, the academic calendar. They've done a great job, and we have a fabulous team on the ground at the school. So that's been terrific, and we are dedicated to helping and working with them so that they're successful. That's just paramount.
That was a really difficult decision. That was something I think I watched the school board and I watched you as well really struggle with, the decision to really shut down that elementary school. And we should probably say the elementary school was built in the 40s. It was very, very, very old. It had a lot of maintenance work that needed to be done with it. There was a lot of resistance to really shutting down that particular school. What was the turning point? At what point did you guys all say, you know what, we're going to have to do this? I know that there was a lot of state pressure coming down as well, but what was the point for you to say, you know, this is something that has to be done?
Well, I look at my own election as a turning point, and when you bring a new superintendent in, that in and of itself is a turnaround option, right? Your citizens are saying we're not happy with what's going on and we want change. I ran on, you know, pro-choice. I'm a pro-choice candidate. I truly believe that parents have the ultimate responsibility for educating their children. And that means that it's our job to make sure that they have as many options as possible. So when I came into office, knowing that we really had no options to offer our parents, and that's why so many of our students have left the county or are homeschooling, for me, that I think that was kind of a clear decision. The state, obviously, and our legislature were putting the pressure on the school board, and we really didn't have another alternative path that would have been approved by the Department of Education. But when we look at everything that's happened since January and the positive changes that have occurred because of bringing the – because of having Somerset and bringing them in, it's all good news. I have to say it's all good news. For me, that was the right decision. It was the best choice of charter company and the right move for our county.
That was Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter speaking with Jefferson County School Superintendent Mary Ann Arbelou. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.